we have renamed Sapir, not the name itself, but the subtitle of Sapir. We started off as a Journal of Jewish Conversations, and now we decided that truer to our purpose was Ideas for a Thriving Jewish Future. And your essay in the education issue really richly provides that set of ideas. So let me just briefly introduce you, Ben Jacobs, Associate Research Professor at the Graduate School of Education and Human Development at the George Washington University in Washington, DC. And Shuki Taylor, founder and CEO of M Squared, the Institute for Experiential Jewish Education. And both of you have been heavily involved in the 18 by 18 model, 18 Jewish things that a young Jew should know, care about, and be able to do by the time they reach the ripe old age of 18. I want to ask you a few questions about this, but I have a sense that many of the people who are on this call are experienced Jewish educators or in the Jewish education field. So previously on Sapir Zoom calls, I've usually tried to take up about 40 minutes of the hour asking questions of my own and then turned it over to the field. My sense is, this is just a hunch, but my sense is that we're gonna get more questions than usual. So as questions appear to those participants or occur to those participants on our call, I ask that you put it either in the chat function or the Q&A function. I'll be monitoring them. And I will try to get to questions much much earlier than usual so we can have more, it can be a more inclusive discussion than some of our previous ones. So hopefully, all of them are reasonably inclusive. So Ben, let me start with you. I want you to paint a picture for us of what the Jewish educational landscape looks like today. I'm guessing that some of our audience won't even know what it means to say you're an expert in so-called experiential Jewish education. They might have stereotypes in their heads of the old rote learning cheder or a dreary Hebrew school with kids just making Jewish-themed arts and crafts projects. Give us a sense for what the field looks like today, what the bulk of non-Orthodox or Orthodox Jewish education now is like in the United States, or at least North America.
So let me begin by thanking you for hosting this and for giving us an opportunity, you and Sapir and the Maimonides Fund, to talk about these issues. I think this is an important question because it gets to the heart of one of the reasons, and we'll discuss this perhaps today, why the 18 by 18 project got off the ground. It had to start with taking stock of the American Jewish education ecosystem. That's a term that the late John Butcher used in reference to it, and understand what its present strengths and limitations and desires and needs are. So I think what I'll do is use a few terms to help us understand the context and the culture of Jewish education on the American scene today. And they're terms that my longtime friend, colleague, mentor, and collaborator, Dr. Barry Chazan, who was my partner in developing the 18 by 18 framework, and I both use in our teaching now at GW about the field, and they're ones that certainly resonated with Shuki as he took the project further. So let me talk first about settings, okay? We think about formal, informal, and then I'll say everywhere settings. Formal settings include the schools that you mentioned, right? Anything from cheders, and there are still old style cheders that exist in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, all the way through day schools, what we commonly refer to as congregational or supplementary schools or Hebrew schools. All of those school settings we consider to be part of the formal settings. The informal settings we consider to be non-school settings mostly, such as summer camps, community centers, youth groups, museums, the list can go on quite lengthy. Shuki works very intensely with many of these organizations on developing their competence. Then I'll say there's a category that I just like to call everywhere. And that everywhere is my belief as a Deweyian scholar that almost everything in society is in one way or another educative. And so that includes media, libraries, the family dinner table, and many other settings in which learning happens, but not necessarily in either a formal or informal way. When we layer on the terminology like experiential, we think of experiential as something that's happening, what happens or what we're involved in, okay, as something that happens. When we layer education onto that, we're thinking about what is the sense that I make of that experience. So I might engage in something. What is the sense that I make of that? That's what I learn from that. So when we think about formal education, we typically don't think that's experiential, but that's not altogether fair. I mean, there's an experience of learning that happens even in a formal setting. And even in schools, you know, we think about extracurricular, co-curricular activities that are not just sitting down and studying text. When we think about those informal settings, we often think about the experiential side of it, you know, happening at a summer camp, for example. And when I say everywhere, I'm talking totally experiential. There might not be any formal learning at all happening in those, but you're taking in so many messages that you learn from that. Really quickly, I want to talk about instructors. Who are those instructors? In formal settings, we often think about teachers, right? In informal settings, we talk about educators more broadly or guides. I think about educational travel, for example. Someone who's guiding through that is giving some formal instruction. Here is where this happens, but it's happening in a setting that's certainly less formal. And so they're really guiding us rather than just instructing us, if you will. And in that everywhere setting, I want us to think about rabbis in synagogues, for example, parents, as I said, around the dinner table or other significant elders in someone's life, and certainly peers. Peers are educators as well, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, but they are certainly educators. When we think about subject matter, well, that's the 18 by 18, and we'll get into that in greater depth in this conversation. When we think about a term like curriculum, we're thinking about the formal planned, you know, experience or program for a setting. But here I want to go beyond that just official piece that's been designed, here's what we're doing, to other kinds of messages like what is the setting teaching us about a certain circumstance or what does it mean to be in a co-educational space versus a single educational space? What are those messages? And what are we also not teaching at all? What are we avoiding altogether? And I think we'll get into that conversation around the 18 by 18 as well.
So finally, we're gonna get into the, so do you wanna continue?
Or? Yeah, I just wanna, last thing. Yeah. I just wanna say, cause we talk about, and I'm trying to, you know, track along with the article, inside and outside the box. We think about things that are sort of traditional in Jewish life as inside the box. And I would use that box as like a geniza, if you will, something that holds a lot of important texts you know, we think about Talmud or text-based study of the Talmud or the Torah and a lot of other sorts of, maybe even the Hebrew School Arts and Crafts projects would fall in that. Outside the box, we think about going beyond that text study into lots of different venues, including, you know, now very popularly online, right? Jewish gaming would certainly be one way of learning that's more outside the box.
Sorry, for those of us who haven't experienced this, Jewish gaming is?
Jewish gaming is, you should check out Lost Tribe. Mm-hmm. They are engaged in a lot of different ways. First of all, connecting youth around, you know, games that they like to play, whether it's Minecraft, but they've built out many sites in Israel, for example, on Minecraft, you know, you can go visit the Kotel or the Shook or other settings, Masada, on Minecraft that they've built out. And this is really engaging a whole group of young gamers and in another way of experiencing Israel virtually.
I was clearly born too late. We're gonna get to the content of the, or born too early, I should say, to the content of 18 by 18 in a minute. But Shuki, given what Ben just outlined, what is countercultural to talk about shoulds in Jewish education at all? You're advancing a particular point of view here. Give us a sense for what the resistance has been, especially from the you know, the just give the kids what they want school of thought. Why are people, including so many educators, afraid of standards in education?
Yeah, thank you, Brett. It's a really good question. And I guess I want to start off by saying is that, like, anything that is not a part of, like, how we view universal values in the world right now, the word shoulds in general conjures very negative feelings. Why is someone telling me what I should think, do, believe? And so I think that in general, that term is one which has become very complicated today. At the same time, I think it's important to understand this critique and where it's coming from. The notion of give kids what they want, or in its better and more acceptable framing, which is you should, saying to your children, you should think, do, be what you want, so long as you are happy, is an idea that many of us believe in. We want our kids to thrive. And what that means, among other things, is for them to have a strong sense of purpose, to have capacities for thoughtful and intentional decision-making, to have skills to figure out things for themselves and the ability to make meaning in their own lives, all while withstanding societal pressures and norms that might tell them to be something different. Now, this idea is actually like a fundamental to education in Judaism. The very idea, there's a verse that appears in the book of Mishlei, the book of Proverbs, Chanoch lanar al pi derko, gam ki yaskin lo yasur mimena, which means educate the child each according to their own path. When they are older, they will stick to it. It will become ingrained in them and who they are, meaning find out who your children are, what they are inclined to do. Help grow that, nurture that, and that will become an essential part of their identities. It best captures this philosophy. We need to meet our children and our students where they are at and help them discover their own way. Now, the question is, does this mean that an educator's role is to be a caretaker and a facilitator? Now, what are our roles and responsibilities as both parents and as educators? The way that I understand it, the 18 by 18 emerges from a school of thought that says that even if we support the idea that students must chart their own path and become who they seek to become and make meaning on their own terms, good education must still offer some sort of vision of what a good, meaningful, and rich life can and should be. And I believe, and I think the authors of the 18 by 18 maintain, that good Jewish education must be able to convey in the most compelling and unapologetic ways the grandeur, the significance, and the majesty of Judaism, its history, its culture, its beliefs and practices, its traditions and theology. And I'm specifically using words that in contemporary culture we tend to cringe at: should, must, ought. The fact is that I truly do believe that children and students must, should, and ought to choose their own path and make meaning for themselves. That doesn't contradict the fact that I, as a teacher or parent, must, should, and ought expose them to how Judaism, with all of its ideas, complexities, and practices, can inspire and illuminate their lives. So the question here really is that in order to reach this outcome of having our students become the best version of themselves, is showing them one such option, the one that I believe the Jewish version is not going to hurt them, it's going to help them. And education does have a say. I think at the 18 by 18 is saying, here's one path, one mountain that I will climb with you, my students, my children. The views are rewarding. You can take it and you might find a connection to your people, to your history, to your future. And then they can continue climbing their own mountains. I think that the critique is saying, don't choose a mountain to climb on. The best that you can do is give a compass, an infinite number of maps. And I believe that that leads to paralysis. I believe that if we stand for, we need to stand for something, and the role of good Jewish education is to convey to our children and students what we stand for, not to indoctrinate, to expose, and to show them what's possible.
Thanks, Shuki, for that excellent response too. What I wanted to add to it really was coming back to the educator. You asked, you know, why are people, including educators, afraid of shoulds in education? I've been a Jewish educator for more than 30 years. I think certainly one who is in schools, who's been in higher education, who's prepared educators for a variety of settings. I have a whole lot of respect for educators, and I consider myself one of them, certainly. I do want to point out that one of the challenges in this field, again, back to the context that I was talking about before, is that we have a lot of great professional educators who have a lot of terrific preparation, informal and informal preparation programs. But we have a lot of what I would call semi-professionals. I think anyone that wants to take this on, is trying to be professional in one way or another, but who have less preparation. And I can understand when my students or colleagues in what we would call general education, okay, who have been certified teachers in social studies education for a state or something like that, they don't typically like a lot of standards or shoulds because they think, well, I'm a professional educator. I've learned all about this. I know what I'm doing. I'd like some guidance, sure, but please don't tell me what to do. I think that there are a lot of our semi-professional educators in this field in particular who are thirsty for guidance. And I think that we haven't been able to provide that to the extent that perhaps we should have over the years. And so this project emerged in part, and it's a way to talk about how it emerged, but emerged in part to provide that kind of guidance to the varieties of stakeholders in the enterprise, not the least of whom were educators who, like Shuki said, were lacking in some sort of understanding. What am I supposed to do now? I know I'm here, now what?
So let's get to the 18 by 18 framework more specifically. Maybe this question is for you, Shuki. First of all, where did the idea come from?
Well,
so this is actually a question for Ben.
Yeah, maybe I'll jump. Yeah, so I was the co-author of it. So I'll just say that the idea came from it was several years back at this point, where three very prominent foundations who support the Jewish education enterprise got together, and as I was saying, they were interested in some guidance strategic guidance about how they could help make sense out of the many varieties of emergent, really interesting educational and what we would call sort of engagement activities that had evolved in the 21st century American Jewish context. And I think for them, part of this was, let's be sure that we even know what they're all working toward so we can be more strategic in the way that we can help them to get there. Okay. And we had talked about a variety of different ways that we could think about that. This one emerged from that as one that all of those stakeholders in the enterprise thought would be quite valuable. It was part of a larger project in which we articulated goals for the Jewish education enterprise, broadly speaking. We also, we developed this 18 by 18 framework as a programmatic and curricular guide. We also developed some standards for Jewish education, Jewish educators and teachers that would help guide their preparation and their practice in their settings. So it was intended as a way to say, as Shuki had just pointed out, what are our stakes here? What is our intended outcome? What do we hope that we're going to see at the end of all of these investments? And it was a way to put that out there.
And why these 18 and not some others? What do you feel you excluded? Let me ask you, if you'd had a 19th, what would it have been?
I'm sure if we go into the Q&A and chat, you'll have a lot of ideas around that. So that's been one of the questions, a very fair question. Why 18? It sounds very, obviously high. It worked out really nicely. One of our, we had a very esteemed, distinguished group of advisors on this project who came up with this, you know, the notion of 18 things over 18 years. So there was a lot of gematria or nice things about the number itself. It could have been 50, it could have been 10, it could have been anywhere in between. It seems arbitrary. And we probably would have left a few things out. The things that we've heard about most often, people don't understand, for example, why we didn't identify remembering the Holocaust as a single, as one of these 18 things, or distinguish in different ways some of the other points there. And other people thought that, for example, this is one to be interested in, maybe, the one about, I want to remember exactly how it's articulated here, partake in Jewish culinary traditions. Okay, I just think of it as Jewish food. A lot of educators have pushed back on, saying, well, you know, Jewish education is much more than, you know, baking challah at Hebrew school or whatever. But interestingly, you know, Pew and others have pointed out how essentially valuable that seems to be to the community. So why wouldn't we emphasize that? So things that we might have left out, things that people questioned that were put in there. I just say, like, look, it's an arbitrary list on one hand. On the other hand, we saw it as each one of the components having a lot of different angles to it. And we hope that it has helpful guidance. There's a much more articulated version of this than just the diagram that's in the article that explains each of them further.
Yeah, I've often wondered if we'd had an 11th commandment, what would it have been? And my answer is hitting reply all on mass emails. Thou shalt not. But let me ask you about your most important client or customer, who's the student. What has your experience been with that interface in terms of their receptivity, and what happens if kids hate this stuff?
That's a great question. I would say, look, there was another discussion I was having about this just last week. And I think that if we have students who hate some of this, it's a good thing because they are still involved and engaged. I think it's so much of good education is not just about the willingness to receive something, but so much of what's inherent to both Jewish education and tradition, the way in which we have received our tradition over centuries, is one which is not just in dialogue, but in argument, and in pushing back and in investigating. I think that we should aspire for our students to reject, to even hate, to argue, and to support them in, first of all, figuring out why. What is it about it that you hate? Why do you hate it? What is it? What does it feel like? What does it do for you? What are you rejecting here? What's a compelling alternative? What else are we going to then build together? I think that the challenge isn't adopting, it's not rejecting, it's apathy and it's paralysis. And the fact that there is no relationship at all whatsoever with so many really powerful and meaningful and compelling Jewish ideas and practices. And I think that in terms of this question, when you think about the 18 by 18, one of the things that I think it, that my colleagues at M Squared and I really liked about it and why we wanted to take it to the field is that on the one hand, it's broad enough to include a lot of things. On the other hand, it is also specific enough to be able to hold ourselves accountable in some way or the other. And I think we should only be looking at this list or any reformulation of this list. And there are two types of reformulations that I want to kind of bring out here. Not as like kind of this living document. It is not what's called, what is known in Judaism as written Torah, Torah Shebichtav, right? We inherited this from Sinai and we're not allowed to budge from it. It is Torah Shebelpeh, it's oral Torah. It is ours to, it is an interpretation among many interpretations in which there needs to be dialogue and reformulation. I think we should look at it in two ways. One is, what are goals that we aspire to reach? But also, what are things that, like, if a child gets to the age of 18 or 30 or 50, I don't know, an adult, you look back and they don't know some of these things, have we as an institution failed them? And in that way, I think, Ben, like, it is exactly the example for, like, the Jewish culinary traditions. I think it's huge. I think that if children, adults, teens, young adults do not have associations that are not just in their head, but also in their bodies and in their memories that are go beyond words, but the smells, the sights, the flavors of Judaism, if someone gets to the age of 18 and they've had none of that, they can't associate Judaism with something, I think that we failed. Now, I think that the one thing that I would add is that the 18 by 18 is not just about the goals themselves, it's also about how we interact with them. And there are choices that were made both about the goals, which I would call here the nouns, but also the verbs, which is, you know, if I pull out an example here, you can say, I don't remember, you know, we at M Squared did some sort of reformulation around this as well, right? Take for example, one about Tikkun Olam, an easy one. Do we say, let's engage in Tikkun Olam, let's value Tikkun Olam, or let's practice Tikkun Olam, right? Those things will mean, those verbs will carry very different meanings and actually change the entirety of the Jewish goals. I would say someone, you know, mentioned about rituals. You can say explore Jewish rituals or practice Jewish rituals or recreate Jewish rituals, and those will have completely different meanings. I think one of the things that the framework is trying to advocate is that we need to have some form of aspiration, and we need to know how we want to reach there. And if they're going to hate it, then that's good as well.
We had a couple weeks ago Bethany Mandel for Zoom, who is homeschooling her children. And one question I have about this is a framework that parents can use even if it's outside of a formal educational setting? Ben?
I think it's, look, part of the, and I mentioned before that this project was part of a couple of other pieces of the puzzle. It assumes certainly, and I know this has come up in the Q&A, it assumes a certain amount of knowledge of these 18 things to be able to then convey them or encourage other learners to learn them. So we shouldn't assume that anything that was created off of this would be a standard plug and play or adaptable for any sort of setting without the educator, in this case being the parent, having some sort of baseline knowledge in it and having some sort of commitment to it. But I certainly think that if that inclination is there, or if the parent's inclination to learn, Shuki said this before, this is a living document. It also should be a learning document, right? For an educator to look at this and say, you know what, I'm not sure that I myself could access Hebrew and Jewish terminology easily in my teaching, but perhaps that's something that I need to grow in, then it's an opportunity for that educator to grow as well. I also want to say that that there's been a question, and this, Brett, comes back to your question about the 18, about how can you accomplish all these things at once, right? Or what setting could possibly do this all at once? And one could easily say, well, day schools could do that. They're full-time, you know, formal educational systems. And I'm sure that if we sent this out to a bunch of day schools, they would say, oh yes, check, 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 right? That would be maybe from their internal perspective. Some of them, if they were a little bit more reflective, might think, you know what, we're not really hitting on this level and this level and this level, even if we have the opportunity to do so. This was designed partly for an ecosystem. That's a term I used earlier, but one that recognizes that not all Jewish education happens in any one setting. So even for the homeschooler who wants to do formal education in the home, might be able to pick up on 6, 7, 8, 10, whatever it might be of these components, but perhaps their children take part in another part of that ecosystem, whether it be a summer camp or some other setting. And maybe that camp is really good at these 5 things, right? And so 10 plus 5, you want a cumulative effect over the course of that person's lifetime. And I think that that's a more kind of broader strategy to think about, is how can this be accomplished in multiple settings in a complementary sort of way, rather than relying on any one setting to do it all.
Shuki, you make a fascinating point in the article about the lack of diversity in Jewish education, by which you mean there might be a lot of conversation and effort around, for say, racial diversity. But as you say, it was frankly unsettling for everyone to discover how homogenous they are. The majority are pursuing many of the same elements of the framework, while other elements remain almost entirely ignored. Tell us more about this. What's being focused on in today's Jewish educational environments, and what's being ignored? How is that shaping, to some extent, the character of American Jewish life today?
Mm-hmm. I think that quite naturally, we as a society, and definitely Jewish educators as well, and Jewish educational organizations, gravitate towards universal goals, ones that are culturally attuned, that are addressing a lot of today's contemporary challenges, and that really kind of fit within how we think about caring for each other, caring for society, being just, being fair, making the world a better place. The ones that are a lot harder to attain are the more particularistic ones, things that are unique to our religion, theology, tradition, and history. And that's because they are countercultural, right? Meaning it's easy to take, for example, there's one that speaks about, one of the ones that I actually find the most countercultural in many ways, which is accessing Hebrew and Jewish terminology. Right, because it's a hard skill. Everything else that's written in the framework is actually, it relates to some sort of experience. It has an affect side to it. This is like, you need to know your language. Now, when you think about the universal, kind of basic literacy, that's something which is universally accepted. We need to give people the language and the skills to conduct themselves, to be able to be citizens of the world, right? No one will come and refute that. But when there's something which is very particularistic, our language, our history, one which only we will understand, that is something which is a lot more complicated. Now, I think that I want to kind of switch the word diversity of goals with diversifying goals, meaning putting it into kind of an action item. I think that that when we give our students, when educational organizations, when educators are giving a set of goals that are mostly universal, that are in conversation with very current moral and ethical standards. We're giving them, we are opening doors to them that are no one will argue with and no one will say there's anything wrong with them. There are more doors into Judaism than just universal values. And I think that it is our goal as educators and organizations, as parents, to open more doors into Judaism, ones that are more particularistic, more specific, that speak to our own culture and traditions. So, you know, when we created, with the support of the Maimonides Fund, a fellowship around this, the number one goal, the kind of the action item to us of the 18 by 18 was, can we help organizations, can organizations themselves expand the goals of Jewish education that they're currently reaching? Can they diversify them? Can they open more doors? And in most of the individuals and organizations that we surveyed, one of the things that we found is that that the doors that are currently open, i.e. the goals that are currently being met, are mostly the universal ones. And the ones where there might be a strong desire to open, goals to reach, doors to open, are the more particularistic one. The goal of the fellowship, I think the call to action of the 18 by 18 framework, is to do the work of expansion, so that we as a community can be proud of our particularism.
So I want to turn, I feel remiss in that I now look at the clock and see 40 minutes have gone by and I haven't gotten to our audience questions. So maybe we can get to some of these and try to get to as many as we can. Well, since it's the first question, do any of you have views? I'm now speaking in my superior hat and my other professional hat, about the Times' article about Hasidic schools in New York?
I don't know that this is the right forum for that conversation right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Melanie Levav wants to know, in which of the 18 shoulds do you see life cycle wisdom and rituals fitting? In particular, wisdom and rituals around end of life. We wait to not scare kids, and we never get around to talking about death and dying in healthy ways in Jewish educational settings, leading to crises in families that could be avoidable were we to talk more openly, early and often, about death and dying in life-giving ways. Either of you want to take up Melanie's
Sure. First of all, it's so important, and it's so crucial to think about the nuances that can be drawn out of a variety of these different places. So I think that there are different, you know, if you're just going off the headings, right, that we put out with the 18 by 18, I can certainly see conversations around this in a variety of different places, whether it's exploring sanctity, spirituality, and prayer, in which some of these issues may come up, to understanding the how and why of Jewish mitzvot, to recognizing the significance of wrestling with God, and so much more. But it's not named directly, as Melanie suggests, and I think that that's really important. What Melanie is pointing out is one of the what I would call the null curriculum, as I mentioned much earlier in our conversation. Some of the things that are not directly taught in many of our settings that brings to mind places where there's a lot of room for growth. So that's one perfect suggestion. And we've gotten a lot of those over the course of time, as you can imagine. The less obvious things, like I said before, you know, remembering the Holocaust, why it's not on the list. Well, one of the reasons it's not on the list is that it always comes up as the number one thing that all Jews already do in the pew, in the pew results. So that seems to be well taken care of. Whereas, you know, I've said this before, but this recognizes the significance of wrestling with God. The word God is the most controversial word in the entire 18 by 18, because Jewish education in non-Orthodox settings seems to have a God problem. We don't like to talk about it, God at all. And so we put that in there as a way of starting the conversation in that direction. And I think that we could probably do that around a lot of other things that have been unfortunately left out of the curriculum.
So Robert Friedman wants to know, how do you propose to measure in the long term that these newfangled techniques, 18 by 18, et cetera, are actually accomplishing anything, a more educated, involved student body than the one in the past, for instance, him?
I mean, I would say that the main way to measure that is, first of all, by expanding what it is that we measure. Right now, the kind of measurements that are happening in the field are usually very specific based on what matters right now, whether it's to our communities, to our stakeholders, and the things that we're looking for. I don't know if we've been looking for this. Ben mentioned, like, we have a God problem. Now, I mean, anecdotally, I can say we have a God problem. I don't think it's ever been really measured. I don't think anyone, like any of the research and evaluation that's done around major Jewish initiatives asking questions about having a relationship with God, I don't think that any serious evaluations are asking about culinary traditions. It's not a fault as much as it's the same type of expansion work that we need to do. So when you start looking out for these things, right, like, are these things happening? I think that if we don't do that, one of the things, as we said before, we might discover in 20, 30 years time that we've kind of just missed the boat on something, on some really significant things in Jewish history. That's happened before, right? Like the when you think about like the major movements of spiritual awakening of Hasidut hundreds of years ago, it was because someone at some point realized like, there's no spirituality left in Judaism. We seem to have kind of let that go. So we don't want to discover one day that we've let some things go. And I think that we need to expand both the goals and how we're measuring and start just looking at things through not entirely new lenses, but additional lenses.
So Peretz Hain, asks, how would you prioritize the 18? Would you encourage the teacher or learner to prioritize?
You know, with Shuki, when M Squared started working with the 18 by 18, we obviously were in conversation and continue to be in conversation a lot about it. And one of the first things that they wanted to know was, you know, is this 1 to 18, is this in any sort of order, right? And the way that it's presented again in the diagram demonstrates that it's not. There's no stage theory involved here where you start with X and you end up, you know, at the highest level at Z or wherever you are, A to Z. There's no necessary prioritization of it. I think it just goes back to the point that I made earlier about the ecosystem. We just want all of them to be accomplished across the lifespan. And let me just say, by the way, and this is important for the fellowship project, we developed this as 18 things, you know, by the age of 18. That was the original framework. And you know, the sort of the catchiness of 18 by 18 is stuck. But most of the majority of the organizations and individuals involved in the framework are serving learners much older than the age of 18, either young adults, not much older, or even adults, some of them still in that same frame, because we feel like, and this goes back to the previous question, the community has learning to do, and maybe this would provide guidance for many organizations, not just the ones that are serving youth, but ones that could help move the community along over the course of a generation or more.
So I'll just add to Ben's point, and hi, Peretz. I would just add, I don't think it's a question of priority of what's more important than the other. I want to answer a lot more practically, whether you're a teacher, whether you're an administrator, whether you're a parent. Prioritize one goal that feels like it really it aligns with where you are. You know, someone here asked about like the disdain for universal goals. Absolutely not. I just think that that's our starting point. It's something that is inherent to us. It's become, in a very good way, a part of our DNA, right? The communal diversity, Kol Yisrael and Aravim, standing up for each other, that should be a given. So prioritize a goal like that and then one which is a stretch, one which will kind of push us a little bit further, something that's not completely comfortable for us, something that not only we want our students to learn, but that we ourselves need to be learned. We always need to be learning. We always need to be discovering something new. So I think that this is both a measurement thing and a really practical to double down on what you know, believe, do well is fundamental to who you are, and always take on a new goal in your education that's stretching you, that's stretching your students, stretching your children.
Right. I saw that question as well about the universal goals, and it's not a disdain, it's a yes and, you know. We use this example in the article. I want to return to it. It was the source of a big controversy between me and a very close colleague who was once a student of mine and is now in a very prominent position in an organization, where that person said, you know, it's important. Our research shows that it's important to have for kids to have friends. You know, I said that's like, yay. That's like, it's important for human beings to live with other human beings in one way or another. We're social animals, right? But that doesn't put a stake in the ground at all for the Jewish education enterprise. That's why it says cultivate Jewish friendships specifically here. Intuitively and otherwise, that's what's going to be able to help build Jewish community, which is what our goal as Jewish educators is. So it's not that we're against the universal value of having, you know, friends or you know, developing those kinds of relationships, but part of the shoulds is putting a stake in the ground for what our purpose is in this enterprise, and that's to build out and strengthen in one way or another, you know, Jewish life.
So Keo, I don't know if that's meant to be Chip, but it's Keo Edelsberg in my screen, asks, by definition, a profession is grounded in a set of explicitly articulated and continuously updated set of standards. What do you believe is the superordinate reason we've been unable to legitimately professionalize Jewish education? Who wants to answer that?
It might be because we can't define superordinate, but it is Chip Edelsberg.
Hi, Chip.
I would say that there's a lot to that question. It relates to this project. I mentioned that there are, you know, some standards that we thought about and developed for Jewish educators broadly that build off of this 18x18. You know, if I'm going to do this, what ought I maybe know how to, you know, care about and be able to do as an educator? I think that part of the complication, there's been a lot of, Chip was the former head of the Jim Joseph Foundation, which was incredibly generous in support of the development.
Yeah, sorry for the naming mistake there.
No, that's okay. In the development of the Jewish education profession and its support of a lot of places that were, that have been and continue to do that. Part of it goes back to the point that I made earlier about the professionals and the semi-professionals. We have way too many needs than we can possibly fill with professional educators in this field. We do a really admirable job, and this is really up M Square's alley in terms of bringing as much professionalization in education and short-term engagement with some of these educators to give them some skills that they might not have the capacity for deep engagement in the kind of graduate study. You know, I run master's programs in Jewish education that we're able to do. But without the investment in growing that field, and we've done CASGE, which is a collaborative for applied studies in Jewish education, has done a lot of research on this area of the development of the field. Without the kind of investment that's necessary in order to develop that profession, we're always going to be struggling to have the right number of people with the right skills to be able to implement something like this on the scale that we would hope. The investment has been there. We just keep on needing to grow it in order to professionalize the field further.
Yeah. I would just add to that.
Go ahead.
Just very briefly, I would say that Ben and I are both in this work in order to professionalize the field, and both have benefited from Chip's wisdom and support. I also want to say that I don't know if this is a project with an end in sight, nor should it be. Meaning, if we look in Judaism, Pirkei Avot alone, the tractate of the ethics of our fathers, is filled with educational frameworks, right? Like, what should you do what can you do from a certain age? What should you do by? And I think that it's a function of the fact that the world constantly changes, that Judaism's always evolving and adapting, and that we're always setting new goals and trying to hold ourselves accountable to them. I would say that our goal is not to reach a destination of the highest level of professionalism of Jewish education, but to see it as an ongoing lifelong project that we are always working towards, and we will never get there. And then what holds us eventually to it is our faith, our belief that we are doing something good and worthy in the world.
So Julie Hirschfield, I'm sorry we're running out of time because there's so many great questions. So I'm really
glad you're here.
But Julie Hirschfield wants to know, who is doing systematic work cultivating parents as Jewish educators in the home, both in terms of content and in terms of parents' personal development?
I think that's happening in a lot of different sorts of ways. We could probably point to, Limud is a perfect example of what I would call kind of professional development for parents. It's a grassroots chance for people in communities to get together and do intensive Jewish learning that's happens in one kind of setting, but often continues outside of that. There's a lot of great adult education opportunities out there in a lot of different ways. One of the things, though, again, this kind of comes back to Chip's point about professionalization. For so long, until today, including till today, based on a culture in the United States that education serves in loco parentis. In other words, our educational settings are supposed to take over the obligations of parents. Parents drop their kids off at a Jewish educational setting and say, make my kid Jewish. I'm going to get a latte and play tennis, and I'll pick them up in an hour, and so I think that part of that is to do the hard work of thinking about, as a parent, how much does this matter to me? And if it matters that much to me, I wouldn't possibly want to leave that only in someone else's hands, even if they're the most capable educators around. And I think the world of Jewish educators of all sorts, professional and semi-professional. But so what is it that I'm going to do in order to contribute to that enterprise? So parents need to want to be able to be willing to pursue that education on their own and to be a part of the educational process of their kids.
Jeffrey Salkin asks, I admire your 18 points. Will there be a subsequent guide to educational resources across the movements that will make it come alive for our students and families?
I think it's certainly, this is like the fellowship that we just ran was a first attempt to be able to bring this framework that Ben and Dr. Barry Chazan wrote to bring it to life. And I believe that there are many who are committed, including the hosts of this conversation, Ben, my colleagues at M Squared are committed to continue to finding ways to bring it to life and to be able to constantly adapt to it as well.
Bob Silber asks, given limitations of resources of small congregations, does the 18 before 18 project have any virtually accessible options?
I assume that might mean about resources or learning around it.
Yeah.
Not currently, but it's something that we would be, interested in building out depending on, need and interest. I just want to pick up, Brett, on the one above that I'm looking at. from Joy Chandler and Joe Nalvin about whether there could be a part two in 81 by 81.
Yeah, I like
for
that.
Us older folks, which I loved. And I do want to say this because it goes back to the origin story. One of those other considerations that we had, so we were doing 18 by 18, but one of our advisory board members, essentially said, look, we need to work on Jewish grandparents. And we now know that the Jewish Grandparent Network has evolved to sort of address this. But these are people that are deeply engaged in Jewish life and are deeply invested in the Jewish education of their grandchildren. And so that might be a great demographic to work with. And I wouldn't rule out the fact that could be something in the future.
And Ben, I would just add, I don't think that these goals are goals to be completed by the age of 18. They're ones to start by Correct. The age of 18. Great. And they will, if anyone here is ever able to complete even one of them, then I think the gates of heaven will be open to you.
I want to thank the two of you for such a wonderful and robust discussion. And again, I want to apologize to the people whose questions I did not get to, but I think that's testimony
so to question.
The amount of interest that your framework has generated. This is a really important conversation. I hope we can find other venues to carry it forward. I particularly want to thank those of you who tuned into this conversation. We are trying to create communities of people who care, as we said, about a thriving Jewish future. Shuki and Ben, you're leaders in offering us an avenue toward that future. But it's something that happens when we have the kind of robust conversations we've just had now.